Hello and welcome to the first Fair Cop podcast. I'm Rob Jessel. Now, as many of you know, last August, Fair Cop was granted permission for a judicial review of the College of Policing's guidelines on hate crimes and hate incidents, as well as Humberside Police's actions in regard to Harry Miller's tweets. But what actually is a judicial review? How does it work? And what happens after the judges deliver their verdict? Well, this evening, I'm delighted to be joined by two of Fair Cop's legal eagles and co-founders, Anna and Sarah, who are going to help us understand a little bit more about next month's judicial review. It's lovely to be with you both this evening. So shall we kick off with some introductions? Anna.
Hello, I'm Anna. I'm from Fair Cop and I'm a legal researcher. I have an interesting academic background in terms of travelling around a bit. I was researching for many years in Eastern Europe, where I specialised in the history of family law. And I've recently qualified here in the UK as a barrister. So I'm interested in all things legal, but particularly judicial review, because judicial review, for me, reveals the very intricate and complex relationship between a democracy and the limits of that democracy in terms of exercising state power lawfully.
Sarah.
Hello, I'm Sarah. I'm a barrister and a member of Fair Cop. My practice is almost exclusively public law Children Act proceedings. So although I couldn't call myself an expert on judicial review, it's something I've got to know a little bit about, because as Anna has said, this is about holding public bodies to account and making sure they are acting lawfully. So it's a very important weapon in any lawyer's armoury.
And just to give some information about my own legal background, I have none. So, my first question then I will ask Sarah, tell me what exactly, and can you explain it so someone like me can understand, what exactly is a judicial review?
Well, having said I'm not an expert, I've now got to embarrass myself by saying I've committed myself to the internet on my website with an explanation of what judicial review is. So I've tried to put this in terms which can be understandable by the layperson. Judicial review is a public law remedy. Public law is that body of law that governs the operation of public bodies, such as local authorities or the police. And you contrast that with private law, which is the law governing activities between individuals, so parents who are arguing about their children's upbringing or contractual disputes. So public law proceedings involve an application against a public body. Now, this remedy in public law is called judicial review. So you can apply to the court to ask that a public body is forced to stop doing something or forced to do something. And you're saying that this needs to happen because the public body is acting in a way which is irrational, unreasonable, and hence unlawful. If you're interested in finding the legal background, you need to go to the Civil Procedure Rules, Rule 54(1), subsection 2A, defines judicial review as a claim to review the lawfulness of an enactment or a decision, action or failure to act in relation to the exercise of a public function. There's a two-stage process. At the first stage, you seek the court's permission to make the application, and a lot of applications will fall at this hurdle, which is why it's pretty significant, I think, that Fair Cop have succeeded in getting permission to go on to the main stage.
And very, very quickly too, the judicial review was expedited, I believe. So presumably that means that the
matter of the public interest.
Yes, yeah. think that this is something that needs to be addressed very, very.
Oh, that's a very good point. Sorry, I'd forgotten that, but that's absolutely true. So that makes it doubly rare. I'm certainly not aware of any other judicial review I can think of recently that was expedited in that way. So once it gets to the main hearing, the grounds of judicial review, there are three of them, and there's obviously going to be some overlap between them, that they are illegality or unlawfulness. So you're saying, did the decision maker fail to act within the law? So did they not understand the law they were applying? Did they apply the correct law? Did they fail to take into account relevant issues? The next ground is irrationality. Did the decision maker reach a decision so unreasonable that no reasonable decision maker could have made that decision? And finally, procedural impropriety. did the decision maker act fairly? Was the decision maker biased? And obviously, they're going to bleed into each other. So basically, what you need to remember is this is about something that is so unreasonable, it's irrational. Mm-hmm. And public bodies must be held to account if they act in that way. We also do have to bear in mind that there are limitations to judicial review as a means of righting wrongs. It's considered a remedy of last resort, so you're expected to have tried everything else before you go to judicial review. They're very stern on time limits and so forth. But the key point is it's not about attacking the merits of a decision. Mm. It's attacking the way the decision was made. So obviously what Fair Cop are hoping to achieve is to get the court to agree that the basis on which the police are approaching the recording of these hate incidents is just unreasonable and irrational. But they won't be going into the meat of it and asking if Harry Miller tweeting a poem was something reprehensible. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at the process, not the actual substance. So that, I hope, is a admittedly quite quick romp through judicial review. And again, I will stress, I'm not an expert, but I certainly hope that that is understandable for the layperson.
Okay, it certainly was for me. Anna, why are judicial reviews so important? What place do they take within the checks and balances of a democratic, law-led society like ours?
Right, well, let me also just say, at the risk of sounding tedious, I'm also not an expert, I should have made that clear, in judicial review, but I am really interested in it. And obviously, Harry, the case, Fair Cop case, illustrates a lot of issues up and down the country that many people are concerned about. Obviously, there's one issue in particular that this judicial review is going to examine, which is the decision, as Sarah was saying, of the police to record what's called a hate incident, and this is a product of police policy, and it'll be for the courts to sort of try and assess how this policy works and what the rules are governing it and everybody involved understanding those rules and operating accordingly. So I think that's really interesting without being an expert, because it touches absolutely every aspect of our lives. This case touches on the way all of our institutions, potentially, whether they're private or public or volunteer, could be potentially subject to the same kind of regulations as non-public, as public bodies, simply because increasingly in our society, the commitment to anti-discrimination, combating discrimination, combating intolerance, this is becoming a universal commitment that companies and public bodies alike are signing up to. The best example of that, of course, is the way in which corporate bodies and public bodies are espousing the same commitment to Stonewall and Pride and LGBT awareness and participating in Pride marches and rainbow lanyards and LGBT allies and all of the stuff that we've seen. It dissolves the distinction between the public and the private. Mm. So in a way, what I'm trying to say is that this, by tackling through just judicial review something that a public body is doing, which actually we can see reflected across the country, it raises huge questions actually of how we hold organisations to account, and that basic position of how do citizens hold organisations to account. In a judicial review, it's about challenging public power or state bodies or state agents who hold delegated powers, which presumably they hold that power because they are entitled to or entrusted to through statutory legislation that's passed through an act of parliament. So in answer to your question about the constitutional impact how judicial review reflects constitutional issues in democratic societies or our constitutional arrangements in the UK, I would say we're looking at a delicate balance of power where a publicly accountable body, the parliament, passes laws through procedures that are again accountable because they have to be scrutinised, and the legislation sets out the duties of public bodies and decision makers who have power through those bodies, and then it becomes a question of whether the citizen feels that it is clearly accessible through the legislation that they should be able to access and understand and read how public bodies are behaving. It should be predictable. I mean, we've heard the words, you know, irrational and unreasonable as a sort of way of understanding when something's gone wrong. But it's also about predictability and being able to understand what's happening and being able to know what's at stake if a public body does something that you don't quite see as fair. So it goes right to the heart of how people feel living in the society that they feel in when organisations and bodies with a lot of power entrusted to them by a democratically elected parliament, how they feel, how does the ordinary citizen feel when that starts to behave in ways that they can't predict or understand?
So transparency and accountability are two of the most important parts.
Well, if I can give an example, the only judicial review I ever appeared in, and one I may add, was quite interesting, involving a foster carer who said that the local authority had acted unlawfully because they'd removed children from his care without consulting him. And it's very clear, if you go to the Children Act, it's a statutory duty. The local authority must consult the foster carer before removing the children. Now, this was a case, the children were long gone. So the local authority actually said to the judge at this hearing, well, why are we even here? Why are we bothering? He's not going to get the children back. He's got no remedy. And the judge said, no, he has got a remedy. He is entitled to hear a declaration from this court that you have acted unlawfully. And that was his remedy. And that is so important, because that's what Anna's touching on. This is about public bodies, which have immense influence over us as private individuals. We must know that they are applying the law correctly. And that's what I think we're all so worried about with the Fair Cop judicial review. That it's actually not that they're applying the law incorrectly. It's that they're not actually applying the law. That the police approach to this, and I think, Anna, you touched on it, in wider society as well, has become so divorced from any legal foundation. It's almost being made up as they go along.
That's the point. You put it very well.
Because that's something that I was going to ask. Because one of the things that we talk about a lot in Fair Cop and in other groups too is the issue of institutional capture. Now, the thing that worried me quite a lot is the reasonable person test. And I think some of the people listening to this may not agree with Fair Cop. They may be on the other side of the argument, people who think it's reasonable to say, for example, that humans can change sex, which we don't believe, but other people do believe that very, very, very strongly. And institutional capture, as we've seen, Stonewall and Gendered Intelligence and Mermaids have trained all these public bodies in schools, in the law and police and elsewhere. And I was originally worried whether this might have infected the judiciary too, but you're telling me that they're not looking at the rights or wrongs of the case itself, and you're saying that the law hasn't been applied at all, so that doesn't become an issue.
It's very interesting, because you're saying there might be people listening to this going, oh, Fair Cop, they're all transphobes, bigots. Everybody needs to be worried about this, because what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If you give public authorities leeway to act outside the law, then one day you might be a victim of that. One day your ideology may not be the favoured one. It's essential that we can trust and understand the law that's being applied against us, even if we don't agree with it. And what I understand about the College of Policing, they've based guidelines on what they must record as a hate incident, which are not actually buttressed or supported by any existing law. And that, for me, is why it's terrifying. It's almost like a runaway train. And that is going to have massive implications if this judicial review does not succeed.
Just to be, just to take that point a bit further, that the it's not just that the hate incident is unmoored from any legislation where people could sort of check from where does this come, and who's overseeing it, and how has it been scrutinised, and how do we have a voice in shaping future legislation in order to either reform or preserve aspects of it in relation to the hate incident. It's doubly compounded.
Okay, so one thing that took me quite a long time to understand is, what is the official difference between a hate crime and a hate incident, and, you know, what is the distinction between them?
That's a really important question that the court will be exploring in detail. They will have to try to ascertain, in the absence of any real statutory guidance, from where comes this notion of a hate incident, as it appears in this guidance that the police are using, to carry out activities which, to many of us, whether we're legal-minded or not, look like criminal investigations. If somebody calls you up as a police officer and says, I'm asking you to do something about your conduct, it is not acceptable what you are doing, and there are implications, the implications are that if you don't do what you're doing, you're going to be in even more trouble. And by the way, we've recorded this in a document which is stored on police records and which is going to be accessible to third parties. For example, in a DBS check, your name will appear as concerned with something called a hate incident. And under the hate incident appears the Kafkaesque or Orwellian words, non-crime. We have something that is not a crime, but it's treated as if it were a crime by police officers behaving as they would were they to be investigating potentially criminal behaviour. And compounded with that, the public is saturated at the moment with notions of hate crime. Hate and crime go together in the public imagination. It is not easy for people to fully comprehend, as you have asked, what the difference is between a hate crime and a hate incident, and it could be argued that there's very little guidance in the guidance as to how to distinguish these things.
My understanding is that a hate crime is where a crime happens, and it could be harassment or abuse or assault or anything. I mean, potentially you could commit a burglary with, you know, which is aggravated by hate, although it's unusual to see how that could happen. But with hate incidents, it seems to me as if the police are almost encouraging people to see hate anywhere and everywhere. And what's really worrying about the hate aspect is you don't have to be the victim of the crime or even the incident. You're a bystander and you merely perceive it as hateful. And that to me sounds very woolly, whereas the police and the law tends to operate to very, very strict and clear guidelines, which doesn't seem to be.
I think the seeds of all of this were planted long ago. I don't know if you remember the McPherson report, which followed from the murder of Stephen Lawrence. And I was concerned. The definition of racism was effectively entirely subjective. If the person you were speaking to felt you were being racist, then you were being racist. And that made me, as a lawyer, quite uneasy, because I think there has to be an element of objectivity in all of this. And I think what we are seeing is just moving further and further away from any attempt at something that is objectively definable.
Including the right of reply and the right to a defence or to a redressive mechanism of some kind. If you're guilty, and I don't know another word to use, if you're guilty of a hate incident, albeit a non-crime, but warranting the punitive outcome of recording your name on a police file, then how do you respond to that if you don't think it's right? You have no way of saying, I mean, the judicial review has been this very heavy-handed, if you like, response.
Well, it's appalling that is the only outcome for a private citizen, because Harry Miller said, I object to this, and effectively the response was, well, sue us then. And he's doing that, but the legal costs are horrendous. I mean, that's a whole other issue, but the fact that a private citizen cannot stand up and enforce their own legal rights without risk losing their house on legal costs.
And the stress.
Yeah, it's an embarrassing position for us to be in a mature democracy in 2019, but that seems to be where we're at.
I thought it was very telling when, Anna, you're a barrister, and you said, when somebody is, I've got no other word for this, guilty of a hate incident, because we don't actually have
the language
yet. And my question around that is how did this all come to pass? Who had the idea of creating this category, of monitoring it and recording it? It's not enshrined in an act of parliament. Did it come internally from the police, and the government then seized upon those figures? What's driving this?
I don't know, but I heard at the conference I attended today, Charlie Evans spoke, who is somebody who detransitioned and is starting up a charity to help other people who've detransitioned. And this was a point of discussion. How have we got here? What's happened? And she has the ambulance analogy, which I thought was really helpful. Said if you've got an ambulance careering through a busy urban street, you might find that another car gets into its slipstream, comes in behind it to take advantage of the path that's being created. And she said the ambulance here were lesbian, gay and bisexual rights. Mm. And the trans rights is the car that's following. And because people have been habituated to accept and understand the really gross injustices that were done to gay people, I mean, people were murdered, denied jobs, it's as if the trans rights movement has garnered that legitimacy by following it, even though I think it's completely different and ought to be treated differently. So that made sense to me as one way of trying to understand why suddenly we're in this position that retweeting a poem, not directed at any individual, but pointing out a fact that a man who wishes to become a woman is going to have breasts made of silicone, that becomes recorded as a hate incident. So I think that to me made sense. I can't understand it in any other way than there's been some kind of bandwagon jumping on the back of the very necessary gay rights movements, because people were treated as less than human. But I don't think that's ever really been the issue for the trans rights movement, but that's the only thing I can think of.
But of course, hate crimes don't just affect gay people and lesbians and trans people. A hate crime can affect anyone who is who has a protected characteristic.
Oh, yeah, and I have absolutely no problem with that. I'm disabled, and disability is one of the protected characteristics. And for me, it's quite simple. If somebody is treating you as lesser, or beating you up, or spitting insults at you because of something about you did not choose and over which you have no control, so my disability, the colour of the skin, a sexual orientation, I mean, I know people say it's a choice, but I don't believe that. That seems to me totally logical. But the whole trans issue is more about mental health issues and how they are treated. And we're on this pathway of affirmation and nothing but affirmation. And that seems to explain why all these institutions are coming down so hard on anybody who dares to question the affirmation model. But where is the legal basis? Because my affirmation is not a protected characteristic under the Equality Act. So for me, it is a bit of a mystery. I think the ambulance analogy is very good to kind of put it in a wider picture. But why, for example, the police have been rushing to create these sorts of hate incidents, I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know the answer to that last question, why they're so wholeheartedly thrown themselves into one particular fight, if you like, which is characterised by a very small group of quite quite rowdy, one can't think of a better word, but maybe political activist is the best way of putting it, because a lot of this stuff has arisen in the context of a call to reform the Gender Recognition Act and to make gender self-ID a thing and replace what are considered to be not helpful and discriminatory or unwieldy medical and psychological practices that provide people with the conditions for getting the gender recognition certificate and somehow being formally categorised as gender reassigned, if you like. And that's why on in the Equality Act you have gender reassignment, not transgender as such, but gender reassignment is the protected characteristic. Now, the problem we are having in terms of all of this confusion around the trans issue as opposed to other kinds of issues, and you know, you mentioned choice and lifestyle over, for example, things you can't do anything about. You gave the example, Sarah, of disability, and there has been an attempt to sort of define transgender as something that you don't have any control of. It's something you're born into the wrong body. It's just the way you are, and therefore it has exactly the same, you know, clear demarcations of a characteristic in the way that, say, being female does, or being in a wheelchair does. Or now, obviously, these conversations can go a number of ways, and people will have all sorts of things they want to say about what is disability, what is race. You know, if someone's mixed race, you know, are they properly, are they entitled to protected characteristic status? And then if both your parents were black, I mean, it's sort of, we're in this ridiculous world now where nobody's quite sure how pure these categories have to be and who gets to define them. But there's something about the trans thing that's a bit different from all of that, irrespective of the complexities. And that is that we, none of us really, and I include people who call themselves trans rights activists in this, and I have talked to them, and I've talked to people who really care about the trans issue, some of whom even identify as trans themselves, none of them can really define what it is. And the population, before it is signed up to commitments, whether it's employees who have to be signed up to these commitments as part of their public sector equality duty, or whether it's corporations who want to show that they're really woke and on the right pathway, you know, so they're environmentally friendly and they support trans people. Before you can ask all these people to do this, and ask every citizen to check their thinking before they go on social media, before you can do all of that, there has to be some clarity as to what this category stands for. Now, you could argue, as I would, from a non-legal perspective, that the reason why a lot of people can't accept this category is it just flies in the face of everything that people hold to be true, including some of the most basic ways in which they navigate their world. Who is male? Who is female? It matters to people because it's incredibly important orientation in how medical decisions are made, how to discuss particular crimes, perhaps a sexual crime, for example. These things influence how we operate as a society. And when someone comes along and says, all of it doesn't matter, there's no such thing as male and female, and it can be changed at will, the population will say that's a syntax error as far as we're concerned, because there is male and female. And then there'll be a backlash when they're told, oh no, by the way, you just don't understand, you're a transphobe, you're a hate bigot, whatever. But the public institutions are then faced with how do we change the whole of social understanding of what biological reality is so that we can accommodate this. And then you get yourself into the terrain of millions of judicial reviews, because all of these public bodies are going to have to be able to defend that they know what transgender is, and they know when the limits of... And to be honest, we haven't had the social conversation, and we haven't had the...
Well, exactly. That's the problem, isn't it? Because this has been Trojan horsed into public authorities and how they act. Because your point about we define it as something that's innate is exactly what the most vigorous activists want to do. Because if it's innate, then it must be protected in the same way that I'm protected with regard to my disability. The problem is there isn't the evidence for that. Quite the opposite.
This is what Douglas Murray refers to in his recent book, is the hardware versus software issue, which is gay people fought for a long time to say, I was born this way, and therefore, like, disability or skin colour or other protected characteristics, we don't make fun and discriminate against people for something that they're born with. And this is what I think the trans argument is trying really hard to push, because how can you possibly treat someone unfairly for something which is not a choice?
Yeah, because and if that isn't accepted, the whole house of cards comes crashing down. I think your comment about millions of judicial reviews isn't far off it. And I think people have really been asleep at the wheel. I think it was seen as an easy box to tick to get some woke points. Of course I'm a kind, decent person. Of course I support transgender rights. But coming along with those rights, hiding in plain sight next to them, was the, okay, well then you've got to sign up for the full gamut of queer theory. You've got to refuse to admit there's any distinction between men and women. And this is the thing that worries me as a child protection lawyer. There's no distinction between children and adults. It's a particularly unpleasant feature of a lot of what trans rights activists say, is they don't appear to see any distinction between a child of, say, 4 and a child of 14. And that's really dangerous in terms of what that child understands. But again, it goes back to the point, they want to say this is something innate, so that child is actually born trans. And public bodies have gone along with this without understanding the implications. I can only hope this is the beginning of them starting to wake up.
Who is actually having oversight of how the police are collecting this data and interrogating, you know, what exactly a hate incident is, because we're building policy on this?
I don't know the specifics, but I've got some very general theories. It might sound a bit conspiracy theory, tin hat wearing, but what the hell, I'll go for it, because I'm seeing it in other areas as well. The police are well regulated, but they're also very much at the whims of political fashion. They're also the whipping boys of politicians, can be blamed. We've seen that, I think, in the I believe policy, where the police were told that they simply had to believe any allegation of sexual assault, which has had horrendous and obviously horrendous consequences for investigations and trials. That must have been a political force exerted on the police. And I think this is the same thing. I think some policymaker, again, thought, well, let's just tick the woke box. Let's get some points for this. And the most cynical, perhaps, and most conspiracy-led theory of all is it's a distraction because there's a lot happening with Brexit and so forth. Perhaps better to put on a bit of a show, get people all riled up about how much hate there is, but look at what a good job we're doing. I don't know if that's too cynical, but I can't... There is no rational explanation for this because it's also mad. So I think, horribly, one of those cynical explanations is probably close to the truth.
That's really interesting, and I think it's... I hope that our friends listening, whether they hate us or love us, will see that, just from the remark that you've made, that the same rules apply to feminist movements as to trans rights movements. That, you know, if a feminist wants to say that there are issues around rape in terms of how rape victims have been judged in the past and the inadequacy of policing, that's obviously a very important welcome contribution to a whole debate about how women are treated in criminal investigations. That's a very far stretch from saying, if a woman says that she's been assaulted, that the person whom she accuses has no redress in law, cannot do anything because you must believe. And we are in similar territory there. So I hope that can convince the listener that there is a commitment in this podcast, and I hope in the culture of Fair Cop to the issues at the heart of the judicial review process, no matter from which side of the political spectrum or which cause or which group is being flagged as the cause, you know, whether it's women or lesbians or gays or trans people or disability people or disabled people, that none of this can be justification. None of these important issues about different groups of people who have different social needs can be justification for unlawful practices that are unaccountable, discriminatory, unpredictable, frightening, unfair, create a demoralised population who don't believe in the rule of law.
If there
anymore.
Are people out there who are deliberately fermenting this because they think it will benefit from them, that they will benefit from an irrational law, I just ask them to think about it quite carefully, because if you choose to dance with the devil, then he decides when the music stops. If you think you're going to benefit from irrationality, you won't, because it's going to be turned on you at some point. All of us, gay or straight or trans or cis, need a system of laws which are understandable, accessible, predictable, fair. None of this is any of those things.
Absolutely.
And it's a massive, massive worry. So this judicial review has to succeed. And I don't want it seen as a victory for the transphobes. It isn't. It's a victory for the rule of law. And if you're in any doubt about how important the rule of law is, go and spend some time in a country that doesn't have it. And you will, you will see.
Hear, hear. Can I just say one quick thing about that? And as she says that, of course, it goes out of here. But I do really want to pick up on it. Yes, about something in connection with this. If you think it doesn't matter because you feel the battle's on your side at the moment, but beware type thing. It's also important to remember with hate crime and hate incidents that the justification given in the policy guidance, in the Fair Cop judicial review, but in other examples of, you know, HR-driven awareness-raising initiatives of why it's important to address hate is the escalation argument. The idea that, and this is, I think we probably skimmed over this, but it's the origin of the notion of the hate incident. The hate incident is not a crime yet, but the argument goes, if there isn't some sort of intervention, what looks like just a comment or just a tweet might actually escalate into something horrible and thoroughly, transparently, and obviously unlawful, criminal or violent. Okay, but the problem with that is, again, from a democratic perspective, is that anything can potentially escalate. You can have a couple sitting in a cafe talking about, you know, the price of bread, and the next minute they're having a raging argument about how you've never loved me and, you know, your secretary's a slapper type thing. And obviously, you know, one could say, well, at the point that one of the couples hits the other couple, we do have something like a domestic violence situation. But you couldn't say, on the basis of the fact that that one of the couple said to the other, oh God, you're not going to start going on about that again, that that's predictably going to result in domestic violence. Now, why this is important for all of us is that we have to then think about the implications for our speech, because if you're going to regulate behaviour in the public sphere on the basis of what might happen, and of course this is contributed to by the subjective element, that it doesn't matter what you think you intended to say or what you thought you were doing when you said that, it's how somebody else decides on your behalf without you having a say in any of the interpretation, then we are opening up a very different kind of society than the democratic one we pretend or think that we live in. Because you're giving the police the power to say any speech potentially might have consequences. Not just words that directly relate to trans people.
But ideas can could have consequences.
Be. Yes, ideas could be. And obviously we've seen a lot of these debates about campus politics and trigger warnings and so on. And there is some concern that, you know, Shakespeare is a sexist and rape is mentioned in Shakespeare plays and, you know, Dostoevsky, you know, and conjures up difficult images and therefore, you know.
Well, wasn't that very recent example? Was it an American academic who used James Baldwin's own words
right.
he used to describe him, being, of course, the N-word, which I'm even afraid to say. And there was some sort of complaint made about her students that she was guilty of hate speech. And this is the absurdity, but it's the logical conclusion of what we're doing. And it will lead to, it won't stop, because appeasement will never stop these activists. It will continue until we are in a position where presumably there'll be some app that will monitor our thoughts.
Well, that's the point, because what you're doing when you, with judicial review, you know, you're basically trying to establish what the law is. Now, if you manage to engineer it, that the law is in place to make sure that anybody potentially at any point could be approached as if being arrested, let's not go there, but as if being arrested by the police for anything that they might say, then you don't, you've basically created the apparatus in, for a totalitarian system where anybody who has power can implement their own agenda, and there is no democratic accountability.
Well, that leads me on to something that I'm quite worried about, which is why does it take a private citizen to challenge this in this case? Because it's almost like waiting until somebody has suffered some kind of abuse. What if that person doesn't have a legal background? What if they don't have deep pockets? What if they don't know that there's an option?
Well, Rob, that's what we touched on about the lack of accessibility of our law to the private citizen. I think there ought to be a state body that would bring these actions, but there isn't. So we're chucking out private individuals to navigate this and to pay for it themselves. And it's wrong. I think we are in trouble in this country, that even sort of basic legal applications are far beyond the pocket of many. Legal aid has been withdrawn. I mean, all right, maybe not a public body bringing these actions, but legal aid. You can't get legal aid to bring these.
No.
So it's become, justice is something that is no longer accessible to the average private citizen. Now, I know Harry Miller has raised money via crowdfunding, but it doesn't touch the sides, does it, for the potential costs? So we're in trouble. He shouldn't have to be doing this.
No.
It's wrong. I'm bloody glad he is. But without people with the guts, the courage to do this, we're in a complete mess, because the public bodies are just going to carry on getting worse and worse because nobody really understands what's going on. They're ticking the policies and they're falling in line. And if you stop and think, well, then you risk your job, and who's going to do that?
And as you both said very, very eloquently, this affects everyone,
yes.
No matter what your beliefs are, because we don't know what is going to be considered an absurd or a hateful belief in 10 years' time or 50 years' time.
Yeah, and if you don't fancy fighting a judicial review as Harry's doing, then you better be thinking about how you're going to do it, because it you know, it's not just this might happen to you, but the judicial review might happen to you, because it's the only way, for example, in relation to a hate incident or some such similar procedure, it's the only way you've got of trying to understand what the law is and what the law should be, or what the decision maker thinks the law is. But as Sarah said, judicial review is supposed to be the last resort. How can it possibly be the first and only port of call for the ordinary person? I mean, and as I said, you know, there are potentially millions of these judicial reviews coming up. But it's supposed to be a last resort because there aren't supposed to be many judicial reviews, because the law is supposed to have some basic integrity.
Because we are supposed to be able to trust our public bodies to understand and apply the law. And that's where it's all gone so horribly wrong. Mm. And that, I think, is really that. It's in a nutshell, isn't it? That's the difficulty we've got. So this remedy of last resort has become the first and the only,
yeah,
at massive expense. I mean, the costs of this, the combined costs of this action, are going to be easily £200,000-£300,000. Mm-hmm. That is beyond the reach of the vast majority of citizens, even with a crowdfunder. I think it's a really sad indictment of where we're at.
I'd like to focus a little bit now on the more practical aspects of the judicial review. Presumably it's not like a trial. How is a JR different from other kind of court cases?
Well, because it's not an attack or an investigation on the merits of a decision, then I think it is very rare that evidence is heard. It's mainly submissions about the decision-making process or the lack of a decision-making process. And often judges will intervene and ask questions that can become a bit of a back and forth. But my judicial review went on for the whole day. It was submissions from me, submissions from the other side, and the judge was able to give a judgment very quickly and made a declaration there and then that the public body had acted unlawfully. Now, obviously, my case was quite simple. It had no other ramifications, and I hope they went back and they had a jolly good think about what they'd done and didn't want to repeat it, because, of course, they had to pay all the costs of their attendance. This is going to be much more complex, isn't it? Because this has ramifications for every police force in the country. So obviously I think what we hope for, what would be a victory, is a declaration that the guidelines are ultra vires, unlawful, outside the law. Mm-hmm. And that means every single police force is going to have to rethink its approach. So it's potentially huge. And I think we were having discussion earlier, weren't we, about this might be a case that could leapfrog to the Supreme Court. So, in other words, the judge might think, oh, this is very difficult territory. One of you is going to appeal, whatever I do, so we can authorise this to go straight to the Supreme Court, which would be amazing. I mean, I think it would be a proper reflection of the absolute seriousness of this issue. It's much, much broader than just trans and cis and all of that.
It's really complex. And also it engages human rights under the European Convention, so... You know, part of the, as Sarah says, it's not so much assembling the evidence and trying to work out the factual basis of what's being looked at, but rather simply the status of the decision. Was the decision unlawful? And we've talked about some of the ways in which they try to categorise decision making as lawful through being reasonable and not irrational and so forth. But it's also a human rights case where an Article 10 right has been engaged, the freedom of expression under the ECHR. Mm-hmm. Well, that introduces another category of proportionality, which brings in, so is what happened, was it proportionate? Was it serving an obvious purpose that would not just protect society from being, you know, taken over by hate-filled groups, but also protect the police from being accused of overreach? I mean, is there a procedure in place that you can show that they followed, that the police followed, that will then protect them from being told that they're sort of acting out of control? I mean, if it's going to involve all these different police forces up and down the country, I mean, as we've said, there's huge ramifications here. So they're going to have to decide whether the human rights have been infringed, if we speak of Article 10, and then they've got to decide... What is it that shows us that there's been that infringement? And it will be, you know, the effect of the action that they took in part. And these are not easy things to just sort of rattle out in an afternoon. And because, as we said, so many things are involved. And it may be that actually some factual elements have to be rethought, because there might be a finding on an error of fact. I mean, that is also something that judicial reviews can establish, but essentially they're trying to work out whether the decision maker made a lawful decision and whether the decision maker knew what he or she was doing when they made the decision in relation to properly accountable material.
And it's listed for 2 days, so clearly there's going to be quite a lot they want to get their teeth into. And I know there have been statements filed, so it may be that there is going to have to be some unpicking of factual
evidence. So is 2 days unusual for a JR, or is it for that is how long you would give for what you expect to be a fairly complex case?
I mean, I can't comment on JR in general, but I mean, certainly a 2-day hearing for anything shows that it's meaty.
It's meaty.
Yeah, otherwise, you know, you get half a day.
Oh, I see.
A day max. Okay. But that, I think, is a reflection of the seriousness. But I'm beginning to wonder after our discussions if it's anywhere near long enough.
Yeah. I know.
That well, might support a further appeal.
I think what you both made very clear is, you know, whatever the outcome of the judicial review on the 20th and the 21st of November, it won't be the end. It certainly won't even be the beginning of the end, but it may perhaps be the end of the beginning. But this is the end of our first FairCop podcast because we've run out of time. I'd like to say a huge thank you to both Anna and Sarah. It's certainly provided huge amount of food for thought for me, and I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed talking to both of you. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.